goat standard flying over their heads. So small a force could easily have been flanked. But you know, Dothraki, these were men on foot, and men on foot are fit only to be ridden down. The Dothraki charged. The Unsullied locked their shields, lowered their spears, and stood firm. Against 20,000 screamers with bells in their hair, they stood firm. 18 times the Dothraki charged, and broke themselves on those shields and spears like waves on a rocky shore. Thrice Temu sent his archers wheeling past, and arrows fell like rain upon the 3,000, but the Unsullied melee lifted their shields above their heads until the squall had passed. In the end, only 600 of them remained, but more than 12,000 Dothraki lay dead upon that field, including Carl Temo, his blood riders, his Koss, and all his sons. On the morning of the fourth day, the new Carl led the survivors past the city gates in a stately procession. One by one, each man cut off his braid and threw it down before the feet of the 3,000. Since their day, the city guard of Kohor has been made up solely of Unsullied, every one of whom carries a tall spear from which hangs a braid of human hair. That is what you will find in Astapor, Your Grace. Put ashore there, and continue on to Pentos overland. It will take longer, yes, but when you break bread with Magister Illyrio, you will have 1,000 swords behind you, not just 4.
There is wisdom in this, yes, Danny thought. But how am I to buy 1,000 slave soldiers? All I have of value is the crown the Tormaline Brotherhood gave me.
Dragons will be as great a wonder in Astapor as they were in Kaas. It may be that the slavers will shower you with gifts as the Kaathine did. If not, these ships carry more than your Dothraki and their horses. They took on trade goods at Kaas. I've been through the holds and seen for myself bolts of silk and bales of tiger skin, amber and jade carvings, saffron, myrrh. Slaves are cheap, Your Grace. Tiger skins are costly.
Those are Illyrio's tiger skins, she objected.
And Illyrio is a friend to House Targaryen.
All the more reason not to steal his goods.
What use are wealthy friends if they will not put their wealth at your disposal, my queen? If Magister Illyrio would deny you, he is only Zarozoan Daxus with 4 chins. And if he is sincere in his devotion to your cause, he will not begrudge you 3 shiploads of trade goods. What better use for his tiger skins than to buy you the beginnings of an army?
That's true. Danny felt a rising excitement. There will be dangers on such a long march.
There are dangers at sea as well. Corsairs and pirates hunt the southern route, and north of Valyria, the smoking sea is demon-haunted. The next storm could sink or scatter us. A kraken could pull us under. Or we might find ourselves becalmed again, and die of thirst as we wait for the wind to rise. A march will have different dangers, my queen, but none greater.
What if Captain Grelio refuses to change course, though? And Arstan, Strong Belwas, what will they do? Sir Jorah stood.
"Perhaps it's time you found that out."
"Yes," she decided. "I'll do it." Danny threw back the coverlets and hopped from the bunk. "I'll see the captain at once. Command him to set course for Astapor." She bent over her chest, threw open the lid, and seized the first garment to hand, a pair of loose sand-silk trousers. "Hand me my medallion belt," she commanded Jorah, as she pulled the sand silk up over her hips. "And my vest," she started to say, turning. Sir Jorah slid his arms around her. "Oh," was all Danny had time to say, as he pulled her close and pressed his lips down on hers. He smelled of sweat and salt and leather, and the iron studs on his jerkin dug into her naked breasts as he crushed her hard against him. One hand held her by the shoulder, while the other slid down her spine to the small of her back, and her mouth opened for his tongue, though she never told it to. "His beard is scratchy," she thought, "but his mouth is sweet." The Dothraki wore no beards, only long moustaches, and only Khal Drogo had ever kissed her before. "He should not be doing this. I am his queen, not his woman." It was a long kiss, though how long Dany could not have said. When it ended, Ser Jorah let go of her, and she took a quick step backward.
You should not have... I should not have waited so long," he finished for her. "I should have kissed you in Karth, in Rhaes Taloru. I should have kissed you in the Red Waste every night and every day. You were made to be kissed often and well."
His eyes were on her breasts. Dany covered them with her hands before her nipples could betray her.
That was not fitting. I am your queen.
"My queen," he said, "and the bravest, sweetest, and most beautiful woman I've ever seen. Daenerys."
"Your grace."
"Oh, your grace," he conceded. "The dragon has three heads, remember? You have wondered at that ever since you heard it from the warlocks in the House of Dust. Well, here's your meaning. Valyrian, Meraxes, and Vhagar, written by Aegon, Rhaenys, and Visenya. The three-headed dragon of House Targaryen. Three dragons and three riders."
"Yes," said Dany, "but my brothers are dead."
"Rhaenys and Visenya were Aegon's wives, as well as his sisters. You have no brothers, but you can take husbands. And I tell you truly, Daenerys, there is no man in all the world who will ever be half so true to you as me."
Bran. The ridge slanted sharply from the earth, a long fold of stone and soil shaped like a claw. Trees clung to its lower slopes, pines and hawthorn and ash. But higher up the ground was bare, the ridgeline stark against the cloudy sky. He could feel the high stone calling him. Up he went, loping easily at first, then faster and higher, his strong legs eating up the incline. Birds burst from the branches overhead as he raced by, clawing and flapping their way into the sky. He could hear the wind sighing up amongst the leaves, the squirrels chittering to one another, even the sound a pine cone made as it tumbled to the forest floor. The smells were a song around him, a song that filled the good green world. Gravel flew from beneath his paws as he gained the last few feet to stand upon the crest. The sun hung above the tall pines, huge and red, and below him the trees and hills went on and on as far as he could see or smell. A kite was circling far above, dark against the pink sky. "Prince," the man's sound came into his head suddenly, yet he could feel the rightness of it. "Prince of the Green, Prince of the Wolf's Wood." He was strong and swift and fierce, and all that lived in the good green world went in fear of him. Far below, at the base of the woods, something moved against the trees, a flash of grey, quick glimpsed and gone again. But it was enough to make his ears prick up. Down there, beside a swift green brook, another form slipped by, running. Wolves, he knew. His little cousins, chasing down some prey. Now the prince could see more of them, shadows on fleet grey paws. A pack. He had a pack as well once. Five they had been, and a sixth who stood aside. Somewhere down inside him were the sounds the men had given them to tell one from the other, But it was not by their sounds he knew them. He remembered their scents, his brothers and his sisters. They all had smelled alike, had smelled of pack, but each was different too. His angry brother, with the hot green eyes, was near, the prince felt, though he had not seen him for many hunts. Yet with every sun that set he grew more distant, and he had been the last. The others were far scattered, like leaves blown by the wild wind. Sometimes he could sense them, though, as if they were still with him, only hidden from his sight by a boulder or a stand of trees. He could not smell them, nor hear their howls by night, yet he felt their presence at his back, all but the sister they had lost. His tail drooped when he remembered her. Four now, not five, four, and one more, the white, who has no voice. These woods belonged to them, the snowy slopes and stony hills, the great green pines and the golden leaf oaks, the rushing streams and blue lakes fringed with fingers of white frost. But his sister had left the wilds to walk in the halls of Manrock, where other hunters ruled, and once within those halls it was hard to find the path back out. The wolf prince remembered. The wind shifted suddenly. Deer and fear and blood. The scent of prey woke the hunger in him. The prince sniffed the air again, turning, and then he was off, bounding along the ridgetop with jaws half-parted. The far side of the ridge was steeper than the one he'd come up, but he flew sure-foot over stones and roots and rotting leaves, down the slope and through the trees, long strides eating up the ground. The scent pulled him onward, ever faster. The deer was down and dying when he reached her, ringed by eight of his small grey cousins. The heads of the pack had begun to feed, the male first, and then his female, taking turns tearing flesh from the red underbelly of their prey. The others waited patiently, all but the tail, who paced in a wary circle a few strides from the rest, his own tail tucked low. He would eat last of all, whatever his brothers left him. The prince was downwind, so they did not sense him until he leapt upon a fallen log 6 strides from where they fed. The tail saw him first, gave a piteous whine, and slunk away. His pack brothers turned at the sound and bared their teeth, snarling, all but the head male and female. The direwolf answered the snarls with a low warning growl and showed them his own teeth. He was bigger than his cousins, twice the size of the scrawny tail, half again as large as the 2 pack heads. He leapt down into their midst, and 3 of them broke, melting away into the brush. Another came at him, teeth snapping. He met the attack head-on, caught the wolf's leg in his jaws when they met, and flung him aside, yelping and limping. And then there was only the head wolf to face. The great grey male, with his bloody muzzle, fresh from his prey's soft belly. There was white on his muzzle as well, to mark him as an old wolf. But when his mouth opened, red slaver ran from his teeth. "He has no fear," the prince thought. "No more than me." It would be a good fight. They went for each other. Long they fought, rolling together over roots and stones and fallen leaves and the scattered entrails of the prey, tearing at each other with tooth and claw, breaking apart, circling each round the other, and bolting in to fight again. The prince was larger and much the stronger, but his cousin had a pack. The female prowled around them closely, snuffing and snarling, and would interpose herself whenever her mate broke off, blooded. From time to time the other wolves would dart in as well, to snap at a leg or an ear when the prince was turned the other way. One angered him so much that he whirled in a black fury and tore out the attacker's throat. After that, the others kept their distance. And as the last red light was filtering through green boughs and golden, the old wolf lay down weary in the dirt and rolled over to expose his throat and belly. It was submission. The prince sniffed at him and licked the blood from fur and torn flesh. When the old wolf gave a soft whimper, the dire wolf turned away. He was very hungry now, and the prey was his. Hodor! The sudden sound made him stop and snarl. The wolves regarded him with green and yellow eyes, bright with the last light of day. None of them had heard it. It was a queer wind that blew only in his ears. He buried his jaws into the deer's belly and tore off a mouthful of flesh. Hodor! Hodor! No, he thought. No, I won't. It was a boy's thought, not a dire wolf's. The woods were darkening all about him, until only the shadows of the trees remained and the glow of his cousin's eyes. And through those, and behind those eyes, he saw a big man's grinning face and a stone vault whose walls were spotted with nitre. The rich, warm taste of blood faded on his tongue.
No, don't. Don't. I want to eat. I want to. I want...
Hodor, 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 Hodor chanted as he shook him softly by the shoulders, back and forth and back and forth. He was trying to be gentle. He always tried. But Hodor was 7 feet tall and stronger than he knew, and his huge hands rattled Bran's teeth together.
No, he shouted angrily. Hodor, leave off. I'm here. I'm here.
Hodor stopped, looking abashed. Hodor! The woods and wolves were gone. Bran was back again, down in the damp vault of some ancient watchtower that must have been abandoned thousands of years before. It wasn't much of a tower now. Even the tumbled stones were so overgrown with moss and ivy that you could hardly see them until you were right on top of them.
Tumble-down tower, Bran had named the place.
It was Mira who found the way down into the vault, however.
You were gone too long.
Jojen Reed was 13, only 4 years older than Bran. Jojen wasn't much bigger either, no more than 2 inches or maybe 3, but he had a solemn way of talking that made him seem older and wiser than he really was. At Winterfell, old Nan had dubbed him Little Grandfather. Bran frowned at him.
I wanted to eat. Mira will be back soon with supper.
I'm sick of frogs.
Mira was a frog-eater from the neck, so Bran couldn't really blame her for catching so many frogs, he supposed, but even so.
I wanted to eat the deer.
For a moment he remembered the taste of it, the blood, and the raw, rich meat, and his mouth watered.
I won the fight for it. I won.
Did you mark the trees?
Bran flushed. Jojen was always telling him to do things when he opened his third eye and put on summer's skin. To claw the bark of a tree, to catch a rabbit and bring it back in his jaws uneaten, to push some rocks in a line. Stupid things.
I forgot, he said.
You always forget.
It was true. He meant to do the things that Jojen asked, but once he was a wolf, they never seemed important. There were always things to see and things to smell, a whole green world to hunt. And he could run. There was nothing better than running, unless it was running after prey.
I was a prince, Jojen, he told the older boy. I was the prince of the woods.
You are a prince, Jojen reminded him softly. You remember, don't you? Tell me who you are. You know.
Jojen was his friend and his teacher, but sometimes Bran just wanted to hit him.
I want you to say the words. Tell me who you are.
Bran, he said sullenly.
Bran the Broken.
Brandon Stark.
A crippled boy.
The Prince of Winterfell.
Of Winterfell, burned and tumbled, its people scattered and slain. The glass gardens were smashed, and hot water gushed from the cracked walls to steam beneath the sun.
How can you be the prince of some place you might never see again?
And who is Summer?
Jojen prompted. My direwolf, he smiled. Prince of the Green.
Bran the boy and Summer the wolf. You are two, then.
Two, he sighed, and one. He hated Jojen when he got stupid like this. At Winterfell, he wanted me to dream my wolf dreams, and now that I know how, he's always calling me back.
Remember that, Bran. Remember yourself, or the wolf will consume you. When you join, it's not enough to run and hunt and howl in summer skin.
It is for me, Bran thought. He likes summer skin better than his own. What good is it to be a skin changer if you can't wear the skin you like?
Will you remember? And next time, mark the tree. Any tree, it doesn't matter, so long as you do it.
I will. I'll remember. I could go back and do it now if you like. I won't forget this time. But I'll eat my deer first, and fight with those little wolves some more.
Jojen shook his head. No, best stay and eat. With your own mouth. A warg cannot live on what his beast consumes.
How would you know? Bran thought resentfully. You've never been a warg. You don't know what it's like. Hodor jerked suddenly to his feet, almost hitting his head on the barrel-vaulted ceiling.
Hodor!
He shouted, rushing to the door. Mira pushed it open just before he reached it and stepped through into their refuge.
Hodor! Hodor!
The huge stable boy said, grinning. Mira Reed was 16, a woman grown, but she stood no higher than her brother. All the Crannog men were small, she told Bran once when he asked why she wasn't taller. Brown-haired, green-eyed, and flat as a boy, she walked with a supple grace that Bran could only watch and envy. Mira wore a long, sharp dagger, but her favorite way to fight was with a slender, three-pronged frog spear in one hand and a woven net in the other.
"Who's hungry?"
she asked, holding up her catch, two small silvery trout and six fat green frogs.
"I am," said Bran. But not for frogs.
Back at Winterfell, before all the bad things had happened, the Walders used to say that eating frogs would turn your teeth green and make moss grow under your arms. He wondered if the Walders were dead. He hadn't seen their corpses at Winterfell, but there had been a lot of corpses, and they hadn't looked inside the buildings.
"We'll just have to feed you, then. Will you help me clean the catch, Bran?"
He nodded. It was hard to sulk with Mira. She was much more cheerful than her brother, and always seemed to know how to make him smile. Nothing ever scared her or made her angry. Well, except Jojen sometimes. Jojen Reed could scare most anyone. He dressed all in green. His eyes were murky as moss, and he had green dreams. What Jojen dreamed came true.
Except, he dreamed me dead, and I'm not.
Only, he was, in a way. Jojen sent Hodor out for wood and built them a small fire, while Bran and Mira were cleaning the fish and frogs. They used Mira's helm for a cooking pot, chopping up the catch into little cubes and tossing in some water and some wild onions Hodor had found to make a froggy stew. It wasn't as good as deer, but it wasn't bad either, Bran decided as he ate.
"Thank you, Mira," he said. "My lady, you are most welcome, your grace." "Come the morrow," Jojen announced. "We had best move on."
Bran could see Mira tense.
"Have you had a green dream?"
"No," he admitted.
"Why leave, then?" his sister demanded. "Tumbledown Tower is a good place for us. No villages near, the woods are full of game, there's fish and frogs in the streams and lakes, and who is ever going to find us here?" "This is not the place we are meant to be." "It is safe, though." "It seems safe, I know," said Jojen. "But for how long?" "There was a battle at Winterfell. We saw the dead. Battles mean wars. if some army should take us unawares.
It might be Rub's army, said Bran.
Rub will come back from the south soon. I know he will. He'll come back with all his banners and chase the Iron Men away.
Your maester said naught of Rub when he lay dying,
Jojen reminded him.
Iron Men on the stony shore, he said, and east the bastard of Bolton. Moat Cailin and Deepwood Mott fallen, the heir to Serwyn dead, and the castellan of Turin Square. War everywhere, he said, each man against his neighbour.
We have ploughed this field before, his sister said. You want to make for the wall and your three-eyed crow. That's well and good, but the wall is a very long way, and Bran has no legs but Hodor. If we were eagles, we might fly, said Jojen sharply. But we have no wings, no more than we have horses.
There are horses to be had, said Mirror. Even in the deep of the wolf's wood, there are foresters, crofters, hunters. Some will have horses.
And if they do, should we steal them? Are we thieves? The last thing we need is men hunting us.
We could buy them, she said. Trade for them.
Look at us, Mirror. A crippled boy with a direwolf, a simple-minded giant, and two Crannog men 1,000 leagues from the neck. We will be known, and word will spread. So long as Bran remains dead, he is safe. Alive, he becomes prey for those who want him dead for good and true.
Jojen went to the fire to prod the embers with a stick.
Somewhere to the north, the three-eyed crow awaits us. Bran has need of a teacher wiser than me.
How, Jojen? His sister asked.
How?
A foot, he answered.
A step at a time.
The road from Greywater to Winterfell went on forever, and we were mounted then. Do you want us to travel a longer road on foot without even knowing where it ends? Beyond the wall, you say? I haven't been there no more than you. But I know that beyond the wall's a big place, Jojen. Are there many three-eyed crows or only one? How do we find him?
Perhaps he will find us.
Before Mira could find a reply to that, they heard the sound, the distant howl of a wolf drifting through the night.
Summer?
Asked Jojen, listening. No, Bren knew the voice of his direwolf.
Are you certain?
Said the little grandfather. Certain. Summer had wandered far afield today, and would not be back till dawn. Maybe Jojen dreams green, but he can't tell a wolf from a direwolf. He wondered why they all listened to Jojen so much. He was not a prince like Bran, nor big and strong like Hodor, nor as good a hunter as Mira, yet somehow it was always Jojen telling them what to do.
"We should steal horses, like Mira once," Bran said, "and ride to the Umbers, up at last hearth,"
he thought a moment, "or we could steal a boat and sail down the White Knife to White Harbour Town.
That fight Lord Manderley rules there. He was friendly at the harvest feast. He wanted to build ships. Maybe he built some, and we could sail to River Run and bring Rob home with all his army. Then it wouldn't matter who knew I was alive. Rob wouldn't let anyone hurt us.
Hodor, burped Hodor, Hodor, Hodor.
He was the only one who liked Bran's plan, though. Mira just smiled at him, and Jojen frowned. They never listened to what he wanted, even though Bran was a Stark and a prince besides, and the reeds of the neck were Stark bannermen.
Hodor, said Hodor, swaying, Hodor, 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 Hodor.
Sometimes he liked to do this, just saying his name different ways over and over and over. Other times he would stay so quiet you forgot he was there. There was never any knowing with Hodor.
"Holder! Holder! Holder!" he shouted.
"He's not going to stop," Bren realized. "Hodor," he said, "why don't you go outside and train with your sword?"
The stable boy had forgotten about his sword, but now he remembered.
"Hodor!" he burped.
He went for his blade. They had 3 tomb swords taken from the crypts of Winterfell, where Bran and his brother Rickon had hidden from Theon Greyjoy's Iron Men. Bran claimed his uncle Brandon's sword, Myrrha, the one she found upon the knees of his grandfather, Lord Rickard. Hodor's blade was much older, a huge, heavy piece of iron, dull from centuries of neglect and well spotted with rust. He could swing it for hours at a time. There was a rotted tree near the tumblestones that he had hacked half to pieces. Even when he went outside, they could hear him through the walls, bellowing, "Hodor!" as he cut and slashed at his tree. Thankfully, the wolf's wood was huge, and there was not like to be anyone else around to hear.
"Jojen, what did you mean about a teacher?" Bren asked. "You're my teacher. I know I never marked the tree, but I will the next time. My third eye is open like you want it. So wide open that I fear you may fall through it and live all the rest of your days as a wolf of the woods."
"I won't, I promise. The boy promises. Will the wolf remember? You run with Summer. You aren't with him, kill with him. But you bend to his will more than him to yours."
"I just forget," Bran complained. "I'm only 9. I'll be better when I'm older. Even Florian the Fool and Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight weren't great knights when they were 9.
"That is true," said Jojen, "and a wise thing to say if the days were still growing longer. But they aren't. You are a summer child, I know. Tell me the words of Al Stark."
"Winter is coming."
Just saying it made Bran feel cold. Jojen gave a solemn nod.
"I dreamed of a winged wolf bound to earth by chains of stone, and came to Winterfell to free him. The chains are off you now, yet still you do not fly."
"Then you teach me."
Bran still feared the three-eyed crow, who haunted his dreams sometimes, pecking endlessly at the skin between his eyes and telling him to fly.
"You're a green seer."
"No," said Jojen, "only a boy who dreams. The green seers were more than that. They were wargs as well as you are, and the greatest of them could wear the skins of any beast that flies or swims or crawls, and could look through the eyes of the weirwoods as well, and see the truth that lies beneath the world. The gods give many gifts, Bran. My sister is a hunter. It is given to her to run swiftly, and stand so still she seems to vanish. She has sharp ears, keen eyes, a steady hand with net and spear. She can breathe mud and fly through trees. I could not do these things, no more than you could. To me the gods gave the green dreams, and to you, you could be more than me, Bran. You are the winged wolf, and there is no saying how far and high you might fly if you had someone to teach you. How can I help you master a gift I do not understand? We remember the first men in the Neck, and the children of the forest who were their friends, but so much is forgotten, and so much we never knew."
Myrrha took Bran by the hand.
"If we stay here, troubling no one, you'll be safe until the war ends. You will not learn, though, except what my brother can teach you, and you've heard what he says. If we leave this place to seek refuge at Last Hearth or beyond the wall, we risk being taken. You're only a boy, I know, but you are our prince as well, our lord's son, and our king's true heir. We have sworn you our faith by earth and water, bronze and iron, ice and fire. The risk is yours, Bran, as is the gift. The choice should be yours, too, I think. We are your servants to command.
She grinned.
At least in this.
You mean, Bran said, you'll do what I say? Truly?
Truly, my prince, the girl replied. So consider well.
Bran tried to think it through, the way his father might have. The great John's uncles, Hotha Horsebane and Moore's Crowfood, were fierce men. But he thought they would be loyal. And the Karstarks, them too. Carhold was a strong castle, father always said.
We would be safe with the Umbers or the Karstarks.
Or they could go south to fat Lord Manderley. At Winterfell he'd laughed a lot, and never seemed to look at Bran with so much pity as the other lords. Castle Serwyn was closer than White Harbour, but Maester Lewin had said that Clay Serwyn was dead. The Umbers and the Carstocks and the Manderleys may all be dead as well, he realized, as he would be if he was caught by the Iron Men or the Bastard of Bolton. If they stayed here, hidden down beneath Tumbledown Tower, no one would find them. He would stay alive. And crippled. Bran realized he was crying.
Stupid baby, he thought to himself.
No matter where he went, to Carhold, or White Harbour, or Greywater Watch, he'd be a cripple when he got there. He balled his hands into fists.
I want to fly, he told them. Please, take me to the Crow.
Davos. When he came up on deck, the long point of Driftmark was dwindling behind them, while Dragonstone rose from the sea ahead. A pale grey wisp of smoke blew from the top of the mountain to mark where the island lay.
Dragonmont is restless this morning, Davos thought, or else Melisandre is burning someone else.
Melisandre had been much in his thoughts, as Shayala's dance made her way across Blackwater Bay and through the gullet, tacking against perverse contrary winds. The great fire that burned atop the sharp point watchtower at the end of Massey's Hook reminded him of the ruby she wore at her throat, and when the world turned red at dawn and sunset, the drifting clouds turned the same colour as the silks and satins of her rustling gowns. She would be waiting on Dragonstone as well, waiting in all her beauty and all her power, with her god and her shadows and his king. The Red Priestess had always seemed loyal to Stannis, until now.
She has broken him, as a man breaks a horse. She would ride him to power if she could, and for that she gave my sons to the fire. I will cut the living heart from her breast and see how it burns.
He touched the hilt of the fine long Lycene dirk that the captain had given him. The captain had been very kind to him. His name was Corain Sathmantes, a Lycene like Salador San whose ship this was. He had the same pale blue eyes you often saw on Lyce, set in a bony, weather-worn face, but he had spent many years trading in the Seven Kingdoms. When he learned that the man he had plucked from the sea was a celebrated Onion Knight, he gave him the use of his own cabin and his own clothes, and a pair of new boots that almost fit. He insisted that Davos share his provisions as well, though that turned out badly. His stomach could not tolerate the snails and lampreys and other rich food Captain Corain so relished, and after his first meal at the captain's table, he spent the rest of the day with one end or the other dangling over the rail. Dragonstone loomed larger with every stroke of the oars. Davos could see the shape of the mountain now, and on its side the great black citadel with its gargoyles and dragon towers. The bronze figurehead at the bow of Shayala's dance set up wings of salt spray as it cut the waves. He leaned his weight against the rail, grateful for its support. His ordeal had weakened him. If he stood too long, his leg shook,
and sometimes he fell prey to uncontrollable fits of coughing and brought up gobs of bloody phlegm.
"It's nothing," he told himself. "Surely the gods did not bring me safe through fire and sea, only to kill me with a flux."
As he listened to the pounding of the oarmaster's drum, the thrum of the sail, and the rhythmic swish and creak of the oars, he thought back to his younger days, when these same sounds woke dread in his heart on many a misty morn. They heralded the approach of old Sir Tristraman's sea-watch, and the sea-watch was death to smugglers when Aerys Targaryen sat the Iron Throne.
"Another lifetime," he thought. "That was before the Onion Ship, before Storm's End, before Stannis shortened my fingers. That was before the war, or the Red Comet, before I was a Seaworth, or a knight. I was a different man in those days, before Lord Stannis raised me high."
Captain Corain had told him of the end of Stannis's hopes, on the night the river burned. The Lannisters had taken him from the flank, and his fickle bannermen had abandoned him by the hundreds in the hour of his greatest need.
"King Renly's shade was seen as well," the captain said, "slaying right and left as he led the Lion Lord's van. It said his green armour took a ghostly glow from the wildfire, and his antlers ran with golden flames." "Renly's shade."
Davos wondered if his sons would return as shades as well. He had seen too many queer things on the sea to say that ghosts did not exist.
"Did none keep faith?"
he asked.
"Some few," the captain said. "The queen's kin, them in chief. We took off many who wore the fox and flowers, though many more were left ashore with all manner of badges. Lord Florent is the king's hand on Dragonstone now."
The mountain grew taller, crowned all in pale smoke. The sail sang, the drum beat, the oars pulled smoothly, and before very long the mouth of the harbour opened before them.
"So empty," Davos thought, remembering how it had been before, with the ships crowding every quay and rocking at anchor off the breakwater.
He could see Salador San's flagship Valerian moored at the quay, where Fury and her sisters had once tied up. The ships on either side of her had striped Lycene hulls as well. In vain he looked for any sign of Lady Maria or Wraith. They pulled down the sail as they entered the harbour, to dock on oars alone. The captain came to Davos as they were tying up.
"My prince will wish to see you at once."
A fit of coughing seized Davos as he tried to answer. He clutched the rail for support and spat over the side.
"The king," he wheezed. "I must go to the king. For where the king is, I will find Melisande."
"No one goes to the king," Corain Sathmantes replied firmly.
"Salador San will tell you. Him first."
Davos was too weak to defy him. He could only nod. Salador San was not aboard his Valerian. They found him at another quay, a quarter mile distant, down in the hold of a big-bellied Pentoshi cog named Bountiful Harvest, counting cargo with two eunuchs. One held a lantern, the other a wax tablet, and stylus.
37, 38, 39,
the old rogue was saying when Davos and the captain came down the hatch. Today he wore a wine-coloured tunic and high boots of bleached white leather inlaid with silver scrollwork. Pulling the stopper from a jar, he sniffed, sneezed, and said,
"A coarse kind, and of the second quality, my nose declares. The bill of lading is saying 43 jars, eh? Where have the others gotten to, I am wondering? These Pentoshi, do they think I am not counting, eh?"
When he saw Davos, he stopped suddenly.
"Is it pepper stinging my eyes, or tears? Is that the Knight of the Onions who stands before me? No, how can it be? My dear friend Davos died on the Burning River, all agree. Why has he come to haunt me?" I no ghost, Heller. What else? My onion night was never so thin or so pale as you.
Salador-san threaded his way between the jars of spice and bolts of cloth that filled the hole of the merchant, wrapped Davos in a fierce embrace, then kissed him once on each cheek and a third time on his forehead.
You are still warm, sir, and I feel your heart thumpity-thumping. Can it be true, huh? The sea that swallowed you has spit you up again?
Davos was reminded of Patchface, Princess Shireen's lackwit fool. He had gone into the sea as well, and when he came out, he was mad.
Am I mad as well?
He coughed into a gloved hand and said,
I swam beneath a chain and washed ashore on a spear of the Merlin King. I would have died there if Shehala's dance had not come upon me.
Salador-san threw an arm around the captain's shoulder.
This was well done, Corain. You will be having a fine reward, I am thinking. Maizomai, be a good eunuch, eh, and take my friend Davos to the honor's cabin. Fetch him some hot wine with cloves. I am misliking the sound of that cough. Squeeze some lime in it as well. And bring white cheese and a bowl of those cracked green olives we counted earlier. Davos, I will join you soon, once I have bespoken our good captain. You will be forgiving me, eh, I know. You do not eat all the olives, or I must be cross with you.
Davos let the elder of the two eunuchs escort him to a large and lavishly furnished cabin at the stern of the ship. The carpets were deep, the windows stained glass, and any of the great leather chairs would have seated three of Davos quite comfortably. The cheese and olives arrived shortly, and a cup of steaming hot red wine. He held it between his hands and sipped it gratefully. The warmth felt soothing as it spread through his chest. Salador-san appeared not long after.
You must be forgiving me for the wine, my friend. These Pentashi would drink their own water if it were purple. It will help my chest, said Davos. A wine is better than a compress, my mother used to say. You shall be needing compresses as well, I am thinking. Sitting on a spear all this long time, eh? Oh, my! How are you finding that excellent chair? He has fat cheeks, eh? Does he not?
Who? Asked Davos between sips of hot wine.
Illyrio Mopatis. A whale with whiskers. I am telling you truly, these chairs were built to his measure, though he is seldom bestirring himself from Pentas to sit in them. A fat man always sits comfortably, eh? I'm thinking. For he carries his pillow with him wherever he goes, eh? How is it you come by a Pentashi ship? Asked Davos. Have you gone pirate again, my lord?
He set his empty cup aside.
Vile calumny! Who has suffered more from pirates than Salador-san? I ask only what is due to me. Much gold is owed, oh yes, but I am not without reason, eh? So, in place of coin, I have taken a handsome parchment, very crisp. It bears the name and seal of Lord Alistair Florent, the hand of the king. I am made Lord of Blackwater Bay, and no vessel may be crossing my lordly waters without my lordly leave. No? And when these outlaws are trying to steal past me in the night to avoid my lawful duties and customs, why, they are no better than smugglers, eh? So I am well within my rights to seize them.
The old pirate laughed.
I cut off no man's fingers, though. What good are bits of fingers? The ships I am taking, the cargoes, a few ransoms, nothing unreasonable.
He gave Davos a sharp look.
You are unwell, my friend, eh? That cough. And so thin. I am seeing your bones through your skin. And yet I am not seeing your little bag of finger bonds.
Old habit made Davis reach for the leather pouch that was no longer there.
I lost her in the river. My luck. Oh, the river was terrible,
Salador San said solemnly.
Even from the bay, I was seeing and shuddering.
Davis coughed, spat, and coughed again.
I saw Black Bertha burning, and Fury as well,
he finally managed hoarsely.
Did none of our ships escape the fire?
Part of him still hoped.
Lord Stefan, Ragged Jenner, Swift Sword, Laughing Lord, and some others were upstream of the Pyromancer's Pissing, yes. They did not burn, but with the chain raised, neither could they be flying. Some few were surrendering, eh? Most rode far up the black water, away from the battling, and then were sunk by their crews, so they would not be falling into Lannister hands, eh? Ragged Jenner and Laughing Lord are still playing pirate on the river, I have heard, but who can say if it is so, eh?
Lady Marauder? Davis asked.
Wraith?
Salador San put a hand on Davis's forearm and gave a squeeze.
No, of them, no. I am sorry, my friend. They were good men, your Dale and Allard, but this comfort I can give you. Your young Devon was among those we took off at the end. The brave boy never once left the king's side, or so they say.
For a moment he felt almost dizzy. His relief was so palpable. He had been afraid to ask about Devon.
The mother is merciful. I must go to him, Salar. I must see him. Yes, said Salador San. And you will be wanting to sail to Cape Wrath, I know, to see your wife and your two little ones, eh? You must be having a new ship, I am thinking. His Grace will give me a ship, said Davis.
The Lycini shook his head.
Of ships His Grace has none, but Salador San has many, eh? The king's ships burned up on the river, but not mine. You shall have one, old friend. You will sail for me, yes? You will dance into Bravas and Myrrh and Valentis in the black of night, all unseen, and dance out again with silks and spices. We will be having fat purses, yes? You are kind, Salar, but my duty is to my king, not your purse. The war will go on. Stannis is still the rightful heir by all the laws of the Seven Kingdoms. All the laws are not helping when all the ships burn up, I am thinking. And your king, well, you will be finding him changed, I am fearing. Since the battle, he sees no one, but broods in his stone drum. Queen Selyse keeps court for him, with her uncle, the Lord Alistair, who is naming himself the Hand. The king's seal she has given to this uncle to fix to the letters he writes, even to my pretty parchment. But it is a little kingdom they are ruling, poor and rocky, yes? There is no gold, not even a little bit, to pay faithful Salador San what is owed him, and only those knights that we took off at the end, and no ships, but my little brave few, eh?
A sudden racking cough bent Davis over. Salador San moved to help him. But he waved him off, and after a moment he recovered.
No one? He wheezed. What do you mean? He sees no one.
His voice sounded wet and thick even in his own ears, and for a moment the cabin swam dizzily around him.
No one but her,
said Salador San, and Davis did not have to ask who he meant.
My friend, you tire yourself. It is a bed you are needing, not Salador San. A bed and many blankets with a hot compress for your chest and more wine and cloves.
Davis shook his head.
I will be fine. Tell me, Salar, I must know. No one but Melisandre?
The Lycene gave out for long, doubtful look. and continued reluctantly.
"The guards keep all others away, even his queen and his little daughter. Servants bring meals that no one eats."
He leaned forward and lowered his voice.
"Queer talking I have heard of hungry fires within the mountain, and how Stannis and the Red Woman go down together to watch the flames, eh? There are shafts, they say, and secret stairs down into the mountain's heart, into odd places where only she may walk unburned. It is enough, and more, to give an old man such terrors that sometimes he can scarcely find the strength to eat. Melisandre!" Davos shivered. "The Red Woman did this to him," he said. "She sent the fire to consume us, to punish Stannis for setting her aside, to teach him that he could not hope to win without her sorceries."
The Lysenian chose a plump olive from the bowl between them.
"You are not the first to be saying this, my friend. But if I am you, I am not saying it so loudly, eh? Dragonstorm crawls with these queen's men. Oh, yes. And they have sharp ears and sharper knives."
He popped the olive into his mouth.
"I have a knife myself. Captain Corain made me a gift of it."
He pulled out the dirk and laid it on the table between them.
"A knife to cut out Melisandre's heart, if she has one."
Salador San spit out an olive pit.
"Davos, good Davos, you must not be saying such things, even in jest." "No jest. I mean to kill her, if she can be killed by mortal weapons."
Davos was not certain that she could. He had seen old Maester Cresson slip poison into her wine. With his own eyes he had seen it. But when they both drank from the poison cup, it was the maester who died, not the Red Priestess.
"A knife through the heart, though. Even demons can be killed by cold iron, the singers say." "These are dangerous talkings, my friend,"
Salador San warned him.
"I am thinking you are still sick from the sea. The fever has cooked your wits, yes? Best you are taking to your bed for a long resting until you are stronger." "Until my resolve weakens, you mean?"
Davos got to his feet. He did feel feverish and a little dizzy, but it did not matter.
"You are a treacherous old rogue, Salador San, but a good friend all the same."
Lysenny stroked his pointed silver beard.
"So, with this great friend you will be staying, yes? No, I will be going."
He coughed.
"Go, look at you. You cough, you tremble, you are thin and weak. Where will you be going?" "To the castle. My bed is there, and my son."
"And the Red Woman?"
Salador San said suspiciously.
"She is in the castle also?" "Her too."
Davos slid the dirk back into its sheath.
"You are an onion smuggler. What do you know of skulkings and stabbings? And you are ill. You cannot even hold the dirk. Do you know what will happen to you if you are caught? While we were burning on the river, the queen was burning traitors. Servants of the dark, she named them, poor men. And the Red Woman sang as the fires were lit."
Davos was unsurprised.
"I knew," he thought, "I knew, before he told me." "She took Lord Sunglass from the dungeons," he guessed, "and Hubbard Rampton's sons." "Just so, and burn them, as she will burn you. If you kill the Red Woman, they will burn you for revenge. And if you fail to kill her, they will burn you for the trying. She will sing, and you will scream, and then you will die. And you have only just come back to life." "And this is why," said Davos, "to do this thing, to make an end of Melisandre of Achaye and all her works. Why else would the sea have spit me out? You know Blackwater Bay as well as I do, Seller. No sensible captain would ever take his ship through the spears of the Merlin King and risk ripping out his bottom. Chiala's dance should never have come near me.
A wind, eh?
Insisted Salador-san, laughing.